who are more like, say, like senior in this room, I am looking for like brutal, honest feedback because I'm hoping to turn some version of this into an eventual job talk. So that would be helpful. Okay, so I'll get started. Thanks for the intro. My name is Andrew. I'm a postdoc at Harvard with Professors Martin Wanberg and Fernanda Villegas. And today I'll be talking about how we can reverse engineer like recent phenomena we've been seeing in language models. So I'm going to start with this comic. A bit of a lag. Where on the left, this man is talking about how AI can write emails for him, and on the right, this woman is talking about how AI can read and summarize her emails. The point being that language models are becoming ubiquitous. And on a more serious note, we're seeing this in multiple applications or domains like education, healthcare, etc. And so, as practitioners, it's a very exciting time. And as researchers, it's also a very exciting time because we're seeing all sorts of interesting phenomena show up, like paradigms like alignment and jailbreaks, reasoning models, in-context learning, and inference time scaling. But the truth is, even as researchers, we don't fully understand why these phenomena happen. And it's not that we're only seeing like mysterious behaviors show up. We're also seeing unintended behaviors, whether it's things like bias, toxicity, hallucinations, models taking shortcuts or hacking their rewards. And so if we were to try to understand like why we see either like mysterious behaviors that we don't understand or unintended behaviors, we can revisit how these models are being trained or built. So during training, we rely on the model's inputs. We come up with some metric to monitor and like monitor this metric over time. And once we think this model is trained, we again rely on the model's outputs, benchmark it against some held-out data set to evaluate this model. But what about all these intermediate computations? Unfortunately, we often turn a blind eye because we're dealing with a few challenges, such as the fact that we're dealing with high-dimensional features, complex nonlinear operations, and an intractable number of parameters. But my goal for today is to hopefully convince you that we can actually interpret a lot of what's going on in these intermediate steps by kind of understanding the geometry of their weights and activations and whatnot. And so today I'm going to talk about two of these paradigms and an example of how we can reverse engineer what these models are doing. And then I'll spend a bit of time talking about more about like the geometry of language models. So that's kind of the agenda for today. And so the first paper I'm going to present is called A Mechanistic Understanding of Alignment Algorithms, a Case Study of Toxicity with these amazing mentees and mentors. So as you likely already know, often these language models learn like undesirable behaviors from pre-training. And so they go through this post-training process, like RLHF, to kind of align their behavior to match human preferences. But it turns out, like, even after this post-processing step, you can give these models these adversarial prompts to jailbreak them and revert, or yeah, revert their behavior back to and like demonstrate undesirable behaviors. And so like this is a case where like we have to understand the model's internals to understand why this might be, as opposed to just relying on model outputs. And DPO, direct preference optimization, is a popular choice of an RLHF algorithm, where it assumes you have like pairwise preference data. So given the same prompt W, you assume you have like a preferred continuation Y plus and a non-preferred continuation Y minus. And DPO works by promoting the likelihood of your positive samples from being generated while suppressing the likelihood of your negative samples. So in this work, we were curious. We asked like, what exactly is happening to these concepts being quote unquote unlearned by DPO? And why is it that after you unlearn these concepts, these models can still be jailbroken? And so we take DPO and toxicity as a case study to understand these questions. And the procedure to answer these questions is actually pretty straightforward, which is to first understand how toxicity is represented before alignment in your pre-trained models. In the paper, we look at GPT-2 and Llama 2, but all the results here in the slides will be with GPT-2. The next step is to unlearn toxicity with DPO, and then the third step is then to inspect how the representations for toxicity has changed. But first, I want to give some very quick background information. In particular, I'm going to talk about the MLP blocks, and many of you might have already seen this, because I know, David, I think you have a paper on this, but like typically you might have thought of MLPs as like having a linear projection with WK, followed by element-wise non-linearities, followed by another linear projection back down. But instead, I want us to think of these operations row-wise and column-wise. And so I'll start referring to each row of the first linear projection as key vectors, and then I'll refer to the columns of the second linear projection as value vectors. And you can think of the forward pass as taking some input vector x and doing a dot product of x with all of your key vectors, followed by applying some non-linearity. And this, whatever resulting value you have here, gets multiplied to a corresponding value vector. And it's, so then your value vectors are being scaled either larger or smaller, depending on these earlier steps. The point being that like you can think of the output of your MLP block as some weighted sum of your value vectors, where the weights are again determined by these earlier steps. Any questions so far? Okay. So let's talk about some findings. The first one being understanding how toxicity is represented in pre-trained models. And our analysis will start by training a linear probe model. I'm sure a lot of people here are familiar with this concept, but the idea is to basically pass in a bunch of input sentences that have been labeled as either toxic or non-toxic. And during the forward pass, we're going to grab the activations from the last layer and try to learn a linear probe model that I'll call W, to classify whether this hidden state belongs to a toxic input sentence or a non-toxic sentence. And it turns out that you can learn a like probe model with pretty high accuracy. So we believe like this means like the language model has a linear direction to represent toxicity. Pretty standard, I think, for this audience. The next step we do here is we can take all of our value vectors from all MLP blocks across all layers. So like in the case of GPT-2, there are like 40, 96 value vectors per layer, and you have like, say like 24 layers. So we grab all these value vectors and we basically just sort them based on how similar they are to this W toxic direction that we found from probing. Does this make sense so far? Right, and so because like the transformer architecture is additive with a residual connection, I kind of think of these toxic value vectors as weights that contribute the most towards this toxic direction that we found. And it turns out that if you take some of these toxic value vectors and quote unquote unembed them, like if you project them back to the model's vocabulary space and look at their nearest neighbors, you see very toxic words show up, often with a coherent theme. Yeah.
Are these the activations or the actual weights?
Actual weights, yeah. So we identify some value vectors that seem to encode toxicity. And so this gives us a hint as to where and how toxicity is represented. But we can take a step further with causal interventions. Again, I'm sure you are familiar with this idea, but the idea is during the forward pass, we take some of these vectors that we believe are representing toxicity, and then we'll simply subtract these vectors from the activations to see kind of what causal role they play. And so given prompts like I didn't give a blank, or she's full of blank, or holy blank, GPT-2 would have originally outputted a offensive word. Whereas if you do this causal linear intervention, instead you get something like I didn't give a thought, I didn't give a suggestion, or she's full of it, she's full of trust, or holy cow, holy grail, holy cow. So these are like the resulting toxicity scores before and after our interventions, given 1,200 prompts that are known to trigger toxicity. So like W toxic is the linear probe. The second one is one of the toxic value vectors. What I'm missing here is a baseline, but like maybe we could have subtracted some random vector or something for a baseline, but anyways. So then the second, so now that we understand how toxicity is represented in our language model, we can apply DPO to unlearn toxicity. I'm going to skip over the details here, but one thing I'll note is like DPO requires pairwise preference data, meaning like given for each of your training samples, you need pairs of continuations that share the same prompt, which like at the time of this writing, we didn't have such a data set. And so we built our own. And the way we did that was we basically grabbed a bunch of random Wikipedia sentences and we let a language model generate a continuation. So we had two runs, like a normal generation and a second run where we used an approach called PPLM to purposely generate like toxic continuations. So this gives us a pairwise preference data that we can use to for DPO and unlearn toxicity. And doing so results in this quote unquote aligned model with a much lower toxicity score. So now that we have a aligned model that's unlearned toxicity, we can revisit how the representations for toxicity has changed after this DPO step. And previously we've like localized how toxicity is represented in these MLP value vectors. And so we can see how those weights have changed. And to our surprise, we actually find that those weights don't change at all. So you can compare the weights before and after DPO with like cosine similarity scores. We see that they have a cosine similarity score of 1. And you can also look at their norms and they don't change at all either. So that's kind of surprising, but we do find that during the forward pass, the activations of these value vectors do drop. Which means like basically the model, the ability for the model to elicit toxic outputs is still sitting within the model. It's just that they're no longer being activated. So we can do a deep dive into why this is. And in order to do so, I need to explain what I call an activation region of a key or key value vector pair, which is basically just a set of vectors that will trigger a value vector. So imagine like if the input to this MLP block was within this quote unquote activation region, it would have a high enough dot product to trigger the nonlinearity and therefore have some positive output and scale the corresponding value vector. Whereas the input vector is outside of this activation region, it won't have a high enough dot product and won't trigger the nonlinearity. And so your value vector won't be activated and won't get scaled and won't be outputted. So this is kind of a 2D depiction of the same idea. And what we see is like the hidden state at some layer where toxicity is encoded is original. Oh, right. So let's pretend like in this 2D depiction, the second key and value vectors are responsible for toxicity. What we see before DPO is that the hidden state at some layer is within this activation region and therefore triggering toxic value vectors. Whereas after DPO, we see the slight shift of the hidden state outside of this activation region, and therefore like no longer triggering toxic value vectors. And so there's this small shift introduced that I'll call delta in the residual stream. And so this is kind of a empirical visualization of what I just said. And there's a lot going on here, so I'll break it down for us. So here, like every point in this graph is a hidden state sampled from either the pre-trained GPT model or DPO'd model, where the circles are from GPT-2 before DPO, the triangles are after DPO, and the dotted line indicates pairs of hidden states that have been given the same prompt. And all of these hidden states have been projected down into two components. The first is the main principal component of all of these points. And then the x-axis direction is the mean like direction in which all of these hidden states have been shifted in. So it's like the delta direction that I showed you in my 2D picture. picture. And then lastly, the colors indicate how strongly each hidden state is activating toxicity, like the toxic value vectors. And really the takeaway here that I want to emphasize is that as all of these hidden states are being shifted in this like x-axis direction, you see toxicities dropping. So like all the red points turn either yellow or green, and likewise all the yellow points turn green. So that was like very low level technical details. So let me take a step back and summarize what I've said so far. What I'm saying so far is that the weights for toxicity don't change from DPO, but we do see their activations drop. And this drop is because we see the hidden states being shifted to avoid regions that trigger toxicity. Yeah.
So maybe I missed, but how did you actually get the delta direction?
Right, so you can simply just pass in the same prompts to the pre-trained model and the DPO model, just record the activation and then
and
just
then
look at the difference.
Okay.
Yeah. Any other questions?
So the toxic weights don't change. So the toxic weights were the value vectors. So you have key vectors also, do they change?
Yeah, in general, like most weights don't change. Like their norms, I forget the exact number, but like there are tiny changes for like all weights, including key vectors, value vectors, attention head weights, and so on. And I think people have been seeing similar observations in just a lot of post-training settings as well.
Yeah, that basically the changes are very diffuse.
Yeah, diffused, minimal, but somehow like very strategic, if that makes sense. And I'll like show you an example of that here as well. Yeah.
Just another thing. Where do you find these like toxic value vectors? Are they in the later layers?
They're like scattered. Like the one that seemed most like causally relevant was like at layer 19. I think like right. So like we're looking at in this case GPT-2 medium. So there's 24 layers.
Okay.
It's the earliest I think I saw was like layer 12-ish, but mostly around like layer 18, 19, 20-ish.
Well, I have a question.
Yeah.
So what is the thing that changed the most? If the value vectors did not change that much, what was the thing that changed the most?
Yeah. Let me go through a few more slides and then revisit.
Okay.
Yep.
So there's this notion of sometimes outlier values within the weights.
Uh-huh.
Did you notice anything related?
Outlier in the weights or activations or both?
Both. I'm working on weights, so I saw.
I see. From the perspective. I see.
So like sometimes if I z squared normalize, there are a few maybe 5%, 2% of the actual weight entries within the matrices, which can be like 100. So that's like an outlier which is not probable, I think. Since the universe began or something like that, if it's a Gaussian distribution.
Yeah. I haven't seen any in this work, but I have heard that sometimes you see like really abnormal activations. I didn't realize you saw the same in weights, but
yeah. So in weights as well.
It's definitely interesting why that might happen. Okay, any other questions?
Thing is that have you seen these toxic vectors getting activated in non-toxic scenarios? Like, are they only encoding toxic vectors, or are they like encoding other information as well?
I don't think so. I haven't seen such cases. It's plausible, especially if we consider, say, like superposition. It might be that, say, like some linear combination of these toxic value vectors also encode some other concept, perhaps. But we didn't look that far. Yeah. If you look at like some of the unembedded, like nearest tokens in the unembedding space for these vectors, I want to say like roughly like after like 10-ish really toxic words in the beginning, you start seeing other what seems random words show up.
Yeah.
So I don't know if those random words somehow form some other pattern, but yeah.
I was wondering on the previous slide, You chose to plot the principal component on a y-axis. What do we learn from the principal component here?
It's mostly like here, I'm mostly just trying to emphasize that like there's a single direction as indicated by the x-axis where like if the hidden states move towards this direction, like you see activations dropping. And this, I don't think this direction necessarily matters. It's more so that
and it's not the principal component. That makes sense.
No.
Yeah, okay.
It was just a convenient way to plot these points in 2D. Yep. Okay, so right. Weights are barely moving, but we do see the hidden state bypassing these regions that trigger toxicity. So we can go even deeper. Well, then where did this shift come from? And to answer this, we can look at even earlier layers. And in particular, we can look at, again, the value vectors from earlier layers and see how they've been shifted. And what we see is, like I said before, these weights are also being shifted ever so slightly. And such that like the model's overall end behavior doesn't get affected very much. But these small tiny shifts, like across weights, across layers, do accumulate during the forward pass, such that by the time you reach, say, like layer 19, these small shifts accumulate to introduce that delta that we've been talking about. And it allows the model to avoid these regions. And one hypothesis that I have is that what I just described is kind of perhaps an effect of KL divergence regularization, where the goal of a lot of these post-training methods is to keep as much of the pre-trained behavior as possible. And perhaps the model is doing this by introducing minimal shifts per weight. But these minimal shifts accumulate in a strategic way such that like it can, for instance, in this case, reduce toxic outputs and like collect its rewards. So I know there was a question on Zoom about like which weights shift the most. I think if I remember correctly, like it might have been like the unembedding weights, but even those were like very minimal. Like all weights shifts were very minimal. If I remember correctly, the one that did shift the most were, I think, the unembedding weights. Does that answer your question? Soon.
I have a question.
Yeah.
Have you tried just holding all the weights constant and just manually shrinking the toxic value vector weights, and what happens when you do that?
Yeah. We have. Let me revisit that question in a few slides.
Okay.
Okay. There's this slide that I never get to share because it's too like low level, but I think this audience will appreciate it. And so there's a lot going on here, and I'll walk through it again. So for now, just only pay attention to the blue curves. And what I'm showing in the blue curves is like per layer, like each layer has like 44,000-ish value vectors. I'm comparing the cosine similarity scores of how these value vectors shifted versus the shift at, say, like layer 19 in this residual stream. So the cosine similarity score between this pink arrow and all the 4,000 pink arrows in the earlier layers. So that's what the x-axis is showing, the cosine similarity scores. And then on the y-axis, I'm showing like the percentage of those 4,000 vectors with a corresponding cosine similarity score. So this is basically saying like, as we get closer to say like layer 19, most of the value vectors are being actually shifted in the opposite direction of the shift we saw in the hidden state, the delta vector that I've been calling. Does that make sense? Just the blue curves?
Can you repeat that?
Yeah, okay. So let's like only focus on this layer 18 subplot. What the blue, so like what I'm doing is at layer 18, we have 4,000 value vectors that all got shifted ever so slightly. take like those shifts, take the cosine similarity of those versus the shift at layer 19 in the hidden state.
Like only the shifts?
Okay. Just the shifts.
And compare it against the value vectors at layer 19?
Comparing how the value vectors shifted at earlier layers. It's the shift in value vector weights versus the shift in hidden states at layer 19.
So it's both shifts, just one at like layer 18 with the weights and the layer 19
vectors. Okay. Yeah, or it's both, yeah, shifts, yeah. Does that make sense?
So it's like one to many?
Yeah.
And you're plotting the histogram is like all of the
vectors. Yep, yep. So then the y-axis is indicating the percentage of those 4,000 shifts, the value vectors that have a corresponding cosine similarity score. So this is saying like most of the shifts seen in the value vectors are shifted in the opposite direction of like layer 19's hidden state. Does that make sense? And we see this the closer you get to layer 19 where say like toxicity is encoded, you see this trend. And if you looked at like earlier layers, like layer 17 or whatever, like you see the same trend.
When you say layer 17, do you look at layer 18 or still layer?
So like if you plotted the shift in value vectors from like layer 1 all the way to 16,
mm-hmm.
and then compared to hidden shift in layer 17, you kind of see the same trend. Okay, so like the value vectors are being shifted in the opposite direction of like the residual streams shift. And like that seems to something must be going on. This seems kind of suspicious, just to be a coincidence. And so to understand why they're being shifted in the opposite direction, we can take two things into consideration. One is that a lot of times the activations of these value vectors they tend to be very sparse, meaning most value vectors are typically inactive. And you have to also take into consideration what activation function is being used in the model. In the case of GPT-2, it's using a GLU function which has this corresponding shape, which means that value vectors that are inactive end up taking a very small negative scalar value or coefficient, which means during the forward pass, all of these value vectors are being multiplied by some small negative value, meaning they end up flipping directions and then end up contributing towards the delta direction that we've seen at layer 19. That makes sense? And so that's what this orange area is showing. It's showing the average activation of all 4,000 value vectors. And you do indeed see that most of the time they take on a very small negative value.
Blue is comparing the shifts,
mm-hmm.
and orange is just showing the contribution of the value vectors to the residual stream.
It's mostly to indicate that they typically do and take on the negative value. So
they're mostly turning things off.
Yeah, but when they are turned off, because they get multiplied by a negative value, they like end up flipping directions and contribute towards the delta value. So in this picture, like I kind of purposely had these pink arrows pointing in the opposite direction. Like these value vectors and earlier layers, because they're typically inactive, they get multiplied by some negative value flip directions, and then they accumulate during the forward pass to build this shift at layer 19. Does that make sense?
I don't get it.
That was really hard to follow. I get it.
So is the orange the GELU activation?
Yeah. So they are typically negative.
Oh wait. So what's the difference between orange and blue? Are they very closely related, or are they measuring totally different things?
They're measuring totally different things.
Okay.
The blue is indicating the cosine similarity score of the shifts.
Yep. In the MLP outputs.
Yep.
Versus the residual stream.
Yep.
Shift.
Yep.
Right. And then so this amazing negative one thing is very cool.
Uh-huh.
Where the change in the MLP output is almost exactly the opposite of the change in the residual strength for these late layers.
Yep. And the reason it's almost exactly opposite is because typically most value vectors are quote unquote inactive. But when they're inactive, when they're turned off, GLU assigns them a very small negative activation score.
Mm-hmm.
And because of this negative coefficient, these shifts in value vectors that were in the opposite direction, residual stream, they're like flipping directions during the forward pass. And then, so like now what was cosine smoothie score of negative one end up coming close to positive one.
See that I don't get. Right. I mean, so it's like the residual stream is the sum of a bunch of JLU outputs also, right? I mean, if there's a, I'm not sure why the flip would affect one and not the other. Do you know what I mean?
Not quite. Could you repeat that?
So your residual stream output. So you're arguing that has to do with the, like, I'm not convinced. Like I would, what I would be more convinced by is if you know, if somebody had a big LM that was trained with ReLU instead of JLU, which doesn't have this inversion, and this effect like goes away.
Yeah.
You know what I mean,
yeah.
Because like, it feels like it feels more likely to be something different than this, right? Because like the, you know, you have this slight, you know, sine inversion, but you know, all of these slightly negative domain things, you know, presumably they're all over the place. They're also contributing to the residual stream, right? So the residual stream is this, you know, represents the sum of a lot of this stuff which has a sine inversion. I'm not sure why the sine inversion would only affect, you know, the individual MLP outputs and not affect the residual stream in a similar way.
So let me try to put it differently.
Maybe I don't understand what the orange thing is. What you graphed in the orange, right? I understand what you graphed in the blue thing, and I'm not sure.
Point is they're all the blue, like all the shifts, they look like in their exact opposite direction, but actually they're being multiplied by a negative value, so they're in the exact direction of the delta, right? That's the point. So like they're like the reason why
the value vector. So wait, the value vector is, so there's a, the JLU is before the value vector, usually, right?
Yep.
And so
so it would be weighting all these guys that are in the opposite direction of the delta. But then when it's weighting them, it's actually negative value, right? So it's flipping them. So that now you're adding the opposite direction to the residual stream.
Oh, I see. So your argument, so it's the MLP weights, not the MLP outputs that you're measuring.
Yes.
I see. So that's your argument. I get it. Yeah.
Good.
I think I get it.
Okay.
And what is it? What are you measuring in the orange?
So the orange is the like average activation of the value vectors.
So the orange is what I thought that you had. So the orange is the MLP outputs.
It's like the GLU weight right before. So let me go to this slide. So in this diagram, like orange is basically this scalar value. It's the it's how much each of the value vectors are being scaled by.
Okay.
And I'm saying typically they're like very small negative values. And so like all of the value vectors that are inactive end up flipping directions.
Okay.
Yep. And so here, like all of the value vectors are being, like, let's look at it the other way around. Like all of the value vectors are being shifted in some direction. But all these shifts during the forward pass, even though the weight has like moved, say, this way, during the forward pass, their contribution to the residual stream is actually going to be in the opposite direction.
It's going to be the opposite direction,
right?
Because they're all off.
Yeah, exactly. And when they're off, they get multiplied by some negative value. And so then eventually, when all these small shifts and activations accumulate, it's what we see at like some later layer where it allows the model to bypass.
Okay.
Does that make sense?
Sort of does.
Okay.
I get it now.
Okay.
I see that argument.
Okay. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Chris raised his hand earlier and also has a couple comments on the chat. If Chris, you want to chat, talk about it now.
Oh, yeah. No, it's resolved. I just wanted to say that it makes sense. But like maybe to the plot you can add like the product as well. That would make it easier to read. To add like a third thing to the plot. Or maybe you start with the product and then you decompose it into this plot.
Yeah, there's a reason why I always skip this slide. but yeah, we can revisit this later if there are still parts that are unclear.
Okay.
Okay, so last experiment from this paper, and this is where I'll answer your question, hopefully. So once we have this aligned model to check our understanding, what we can do is we can scale some of these key or value vectors to undo unalignment. In particular, if we take the key vectors corresponding to toxic value vectors, we can scale these key vectors larger, which in turn will also scale their activation regions larger. Because remember, the activation region is defined by like the dot product with each key vector. And we can scale these key vectors larger such that even after the shift in the model's like hidden state, this hidden state is now once again within this activation region and triggering our toxic value vectors. And so in the paper, we show that as by scaling as few as 7 of these key vectors, we can revert the model back to its toxic behavior. So to answer your question, we can do this the other way around where we play with the value vector, like scale them smaller. But what we found was like working with the key vectors is more effective because if you scale these value vectors either too small or too large, like they end up affecting the model in kind of unexpected ways, especially when you combine like 7 of these value vectors, because like the value vectors, I suppose, I think of as writing directly to the residual stream, whereas the key vectors, you're just deciding what to read. That makes sense. Yeah, so both probably, there's probably some sweet spot of like how much you carefully scale these value vectors, but we found the key vectors to be stable. Okay, so that's like the first project where we show by really understanding the representations of some concept like toxicity, we can understand like what exactly these alignment algorithms are doing, what they're doing to these unlearned concepts and why things like jailbreaks can happen. And since the publication of his work, numerous researchers have suggested other ways of doing alignment to address this type of issue. Any questions before I move on? Yeah.
So maybe this is covered in one of the citations there, but is your intuition that we should be doing DPO on like the frozen value vectors, for example, and that would prevent jailbreaks?
I think that's one way. Like, so some of these approaches do is like they do two passes where in the first pass, they identify weights that are most relevant for some concept. And then they freeze all weights except for those weights that seem to matter most and only update those weights. One thing that I wanted to try or that I tried very briefly is to augment the say DPO loss with some sparsity term, so that the model is encouraged to update as few parameters as possible, but update those aggressively. But I couldn't get the model to train Like it was too unstable when I tried that, and maybe if I maybe it would work, but I've only tried it for like a year or two.
Cool.
Like, yeah. Okay.
I think Chris raises it.
Yep.
Thank you. Have you also looked at like language models that are using something like a Gecko, where you have like these two branches in the thing that would, so you wouldn't just have like the keys as in your MLP, but you would have like a separate set of keys.
Yeah. Yes. So this next project, we'll talk about that.
All right, cool.
Yep. And so I'll get into that. Actually, Chris is on this paper. okay, so you've probably been seeing like these reasoning models, and the way they work is it generates some chain of thought sequence. And so there's been questions on like whether these chains of thoughts are faithful, meaning do these chains of thought actually reflect what the like the computations the model is doing internally? And especially as we give these models harder problems, it might be useful that these chain of thoughts sequences are faithful so that we can kind of understand how it's doing reasoning. But apparently researchers have found that these chains of thoughts are often not faithful. And so in this work, what motivated this work was to study if we can, instead of like monitoring these chains of thought, if we can monitor their inner computations and latent space instead. And so this is again a problem where you have to understand the model's internals and not just rely on the model's outputs. And so to kind of scope our work, we picked a very specific skill. So like reasoning entails all sorts of skills, but we focused on a very specific one, which is self-verification. And we study like how the model does self-verification. Again, so some very quick background information, and this is where I'll talk about gated linear units, which is kind of the same thing, except it's kind of the same thing in that gated linear units are also just some weighted sum of its value vectors. It's just that now what determines the scale of each value vector goes through some additional steps. So now there are two key vectors, I guess k gate and k up. I'll just probably still refer to these as key vectors. So that's one difference. And like previously, I was describing what I call an activation region. It's a subspace that triggers a value vector. And so similarly, your gated linear units will also have some activation region characterized by these two key vectors. And it's perhaps a more like complicated subspace, so I might just refer to these as polytopes. But other than those differences, like they're kind of the same thing. I'm going to skip over these slides mostly because I think this audience is familiar with this idea of QK circuits and OV circuits, where the QK circuits decide what information to read from the residual stream, OV circuits decide what to write to the residual stream. Okay, so the setup that we came up with is we're looking for a task that requires reasoning and self-verification. And this task called countdown meets both criteria where what the task is, we basically give the model a set of operands, for instance, 20, 14, and 40. And we ask the model to come up with some arithmetic combination that reaches a target number, in this case, 28. So we train a language model. We train Qwen 2.53b using like DeepSeek R1's recipe, which is basically to just simply apply gRPO with two rewards. One is you reward the model if it reaches a correct solution, as well as another reward for following some specified format. In this case, like the format is to produce its chain of thought between these think tokens and provide the final answer between these answer tokens. One thing that we take advantage of is what's called node collapse. So people have noticed that with preference tuning, often these models run into mode collapse, by which they mean These models become overly like focused. I don't want to say yeah, these models become too like focused on just satisfying what preference it needs to satisfy according to its like RL loss, such that even at the cost of diversity, it will always generate things that satisfy the preference in your either data or reward model, which I think perhaps is why most language models sound the same these days. And we leverage this as a feature and not a bug. And so I think this next slide will actually make more sense, where given a training sample like this, after a few gradient steps, the model will learn the task. So it will generate some long chain of thought where it will try an attempt and say, it will verify its answer. This didn't work. Let's try something else until it eventually reaches the right answer. But even after this point, if you train for longer, for say like 300 gradient steps, you run into mode collapse where the model converges to always generating this very systematic, structured chain of thought all the time. So that's what I mean by mode collapse. And of course, with like, you might have experienced this where like with mechinterp, it's very tedious to try to get this formatting right to know where to probe for and et cetera. And so we take advantage of mode collapse here. And so like in your projects, like as you're looking for an appropriate setup, keep in mind that mode collapse might be a suitable option for you to make your lives easier. Okay, so now that we have a model that's doing like both reasoning and self-verification, we can look at how it's doing self-verification. And so I'll provide a top-down and bottom-up analysis and show how they might meet in the middle. So the top-down analysis is very similar to what we did before. Same recipe. We're going to start with a linear probe from the last layer. In particular, we're going to take the hidden states for all the time steps where the model has made an attempt at a solution. We're going to take the residual streams at those time steps and train this linear vector. With this probe, I guess the shape of the probe is like 2 by D, where it's mapping from a d-dimensional space to two outputs. And so I'll refer to the direction for like trying to classify that the attempt is valid as W valid and the opposite direction as W invalid. But once we train this probe, typical thing, like you can steer the model with this linear probe where even given some attempt where the model has not found the solution in this left side, you can like add this vector to make the model think that it has found a solution. And so it'll say, oh yes, we found the answer and output the attempt, even though it's not correct. But what we do here is, again, same thing as the toxicity setup, where given this W valid direction, we look for all value vectors once again that is most similar to our W valid direction. And so kind of the same thing. Well, then what happens if you unembed these probe directions or value vector directions? And you see these words related to verification show up. So in the case of W valid, you see words like exactly, yes, equal signs show up. Interestingly, we see this like pound, 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 pound sign show up. Any guesses as to why or what that is? So my guess is like, if you look at the training data for GSM8K, the training data will have some chain of thought followed by pound, 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 and then final answer. And I think that's kind of why, that might be why this pound, 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 pound is showing up here. Same thing for W invalid. You see words related to verification. For some reason, we see like Chinese words show up though, which translate to unfinished, unable, and et cetera. Same thing with the value vectors. You can unembed them to see words like is success, accurately, and so on. Same thing with invalid. You see, again, for some reason, Chinese words for that translate to difficult, can't reach, doesn't exist, and so on. So, yeah.
Have you checked their full logit distribution? Like, are they systematically promoting these concepts, or does the logit distribution kind of like seem uniform? Like, why I'm asking that is that even if you see small differences in the logit distribution, it is going to get expanded when you project it with softmax, of course, right?
Yeah.
So, and also, like, if something has the right shape, you can, of course, project it in the Bokole space. So you'll always end up seeing something. And because of how word embeddings are trained, you are going to see similar things clustered together on the top.
I'm not sure I understood the second half, but we haven't looked at the logic distributions. I understand how like softmax can explode like some the likelihood of some token from being outputted.
Like even if the value is like, let's say two values, like with logic values like 20.1 versus 19.9,
mm-hmm.
if you project it with exponential like geometry,
yep.
it is going to the 20.1 yep. is going to get exploded.
Yep.
But if all the or most of the values in the vocabulary get assigned a distribution between 22 and 18,
mm-hmm.
then maybe the model does not really have a very strong preference for those concepts only. Does that make sense?
You're saying if the logit distribution is somewhat uniform.
Yeah.
Sorry, I didn't understand the question.
Okay, maybe I'm not asking it right. Okay. So
so you're not asking about the logit distribution given some chain of thought.
I'm asking about the kind of like this approach in general to localize a concept in certain value vectors. I think that like if it has the right shape, you can of course project it to something. It will say something,
yep.
right? But if you do not see like systematic promotion of certain concepts and systematic suppression of other things, you cannot be really sure that this value vector is actually doing something that is very specific, like promoting this concept. And that is why I'm asking that if the distribution looks kind of uniform, then this is kind of like a little bit counterintuitive.
I think I understand better. We haven't looked at the logit distribution, but like that's kind of where you can do, like to understand what role these value vectors play, we can do causal interventions. So like for instance, here, this is exactly what we do.
Yeah.
So here we give the model like 300 samples, yeah. test cases, and we basically, like right after the model has found a solution where it needs to do self-verification, we turn off a set of GLU valid vectors, value vectors. In particular, like we turn off like 50 per layer, where those 50 are selected just based on how similar they are to the W valid direction, the probe direction.
Yeah, I understand that
yep.
part. But my, so sorry for taking so long.
No.
My criticism for that will be that
yep.
it will always work, this causal intervention.
Because they're specifically turning off
yeah,
certain
because
tokens.
They're specifically turning on or off specific words, which
yeah.
maybe accidentally get decoded in
yeah.
the big one in the vocabulary space. And
yeah,
I see
what you mean.
Slightly
yeah.
in
I
that direction. And since it is an editing update.
Yeah.
And of course in later layers, if you add something in layer 15, it is going to get exploded in later
yeah,
layers.
Okay. I see what you mean now. I guess two things. One
yeah.
is like that this exact point where we intervene.
Yeah.
Like it's it will either like predict like not 28 or this works, but like we purposely intervene right when an attempt is made, where the next character being predicted is the open parentheses and not like answer or incorrect, if that makes sense. But so that's
at the last token position, right?
We intervene at the last token position, but it's not directly predicting yes or no at this point. It's predicting like the open parentheses. That's like one thing. The other thing is like I see what you mean, and I think often like this is kind of going to be hand wavy, but like if you imagine the token embeddings, like we see like clusters, like in the case of toxicity we saw like cuss words, in this case we saw words related to verification, and my like working hypothesis is that like the model builds some like higher level representation of some concept. But it just happens to be that when they're projected to the embedding space, you see like relevant tokens. So like a good way to test your hypothesis would be like in a lot of the toxic, in the case of toxicity, we saw a lot of value vectors that were similar to the toxic direction, but not necessarily near like cuss words in the unembedding space.
Yeah.
So maybe if we only intervened on these non-toxic, sorry, non like cuss word value vectors and still saw a drop in like toxic outputs, maybe that's one way to control for test.
Or maybe another thing could be that if you ablate those toxic vectors all together and try to make the model say something toxic. Like somehow, then the model can still find workarounds to say the toxic words. Like by ablating, I mean zero ablate, mm-hmm. like not like some negative.
Yeah, I think ultimately what is a good question here is like, what is the relationship between like hidden state representations and the embeddings that happen to be near them? Like, I think there's some interesting relationship there. Like, why is it that if you unembed these concept representations, you see tokens related to that concept show up? I think that's ultimately like what might be the most interesting question here.
Because that is how you located them.
It is. It happened that like often it works when you find these patterns. So like empirically, I'm just like reusing this method over and over again, but there's still an unknown there, like why.
Well, for the toxic case,
yeah,
that's how you found that, right? But for this reasoning case, it's not how you found it, right? Is it your probe is not you're not probing at the point when it's saying got it or didn't get it or something like that, right? You're probing at a different point.
We are probing like right when a attempt is made. So at in this case, we're probing like at these squared time steps.
Right. So you're not probing at the place where it would say, you know, yes or no. You're probing at a different place, right? Mm-hmm. So this is, I mean, it is a little bit, it's surprising, right?
Yeah.
The vocabulary.
It kind of is about to say yes or no, but it says it in a special way. Like, because it is saying not, you know, this works.
Yeah.
But it's like.
Oh, in case there's any confusion, like the parentheses, not 28.
It's not in the text.
It is. This is what the language model is saying.
Oh, it is.
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, I see.
But what I want to say is, like, right after it says, for instance, negative 10, it doesn't predict not. It has to predict open parentheses and then not.
I see. Oh, but it's pretty close.
No,
it's getting ready to say no.
It's getting ready to say no.
Yeah, but it's not literally saying the token. No.
Yeah.
I see.
It has already decided that what it wants to say, but it is saying that in a specific format.
Yeah.
Okay.
Okay, cool. Yeah. Thank you. I mean, I could probably let you finish your presentation.
Yeah. I've thought about like what you've asked a lot, and like in the last paper, I think we'll revisit this idea of concepts and token, the relationship between like concept representations and their token, there's tokens. Okay, so we've identified these GLU value vectors that we think are relevant for self-verification. We can do the same thing. We can turn these off during right before it tries to do self-verification. And there's like three possible outcomes that we see here. One is the intervention fails, and so the model will still correctly verify its output and output this works and output the answer. In the case when the intervention worked, we can make the model fail at self-verification and say, oh, this is not equal to 28, so let's try some other things, and it will indefinitely continue its chain of thought forever. Interestingly, we see sometimes a case of partial success where we initially are able to disable self-verification, but then the model self-corrects itself and says, wait, what we just tried is actually correct, and so this is the answer. I guess just to, when we intervene, we are only intervening at that specific type step, and we don't intervene at any other type step.
When it corrects itself, does it always correct itself right away, or does it ever correct itself some number of steps later?
It's usually almost right after. Yeah. I think by the time it's like moved on, it never comes back again. Sure. So you end up seeing actually a very low success rate here. What's kind of funny here is here we're just grabbing the value vectors that are most similar to this W valid probe direction. But you can also grab the value vectors that are most similar to your like W invalid direction and also turn those off as well. And like intuitively, you might think the like invalid direction shouldn't matter when it's trying to do self-verification. And so why you see this improvement is, again, like you have to think of the geometry of these vectors, where if you take some of your value vectors for valid and flip them and then unembed them, you see the opposite semantics show up. So you see words like wrong, invalid, bad, failure, and so on. Same thing with the invalid value vectors. They originally encode things like failed, not enough. But if you flip their directions and unembed it, you see words like successful, smooth, finally, equal, sufficient, and so on show up. So like the same idea here, even though this like W invalid direction seems to encode like invalid tokens, like during the forward pass, because they're inactive, they get multiplied by some negative value, end up pointing in the valid direction, and then contribute for self-verification. So this is kind of why we see this bump in intervention success rate. But there's still this other like 50% to explain for.
Andrew, does it ever happen that because in the Gecklu architecture, you could also multiply them with a negative number, right? So you put them through your activation function and they would be on the positive side, but like the second branch theoretically could output a negative number, right?
Second branch being...
You know, like you have two key matrices.
Yeah, that's a good point.
Does this ever happen? Like, yeah, I would imagine that this may give rise to the value vectors being meaningful into both directions as well.
Yeah, that's a good point. I should check the actual activations and see that they are negative. I haven't looked at that. Good point. So that's kind of the top-down analysis. We started by probing at the last layer, looking for weights that are similar to it. Now I'll show you a bottom-up analysis. The thing about this task is that the task actually specifies what the correct answer is in the context. And so a reasonable approach for the transformer model to check its solution is to simply attend to this time step and compare like what it just outputted against like the answer provided in the context. And so we basically look for attention heads that spend at least 10% of its attention to the answer token. And I'll just start referring to these as previous token heads. And this isn't like new. People have found previous token heads before. They seem to play a role in induction heads and so on. And so in the case of Qwen 3B, there are, I suppose, 33 previous token heads. And it turns out that if you turn off these 33 attention heads, you get perfect intervention success rates. And so then the model will always fail at self-verification and generate its chain of thought forever. One thing that you might wonder is whether there's a relationship between these value vectors that we found before and these attention heads, these previous token heads. And my claim is that these two sets of weights share the same quote-unquote verification subspace. So what do I mean by this? So this is where we'll revisit like the QK and OV circuits, where OV determines what information to write, QK determines what information to read. And people have suggested what they call like interlayer communication channels, where they come up with this composition score to decide which attention heads are talking to each other. So here W1 might refer to an OV circuit of one head, where W2 might be the QK circuit of another head. And the more these two values are aligned, the more it might be that these two attention heads are talking to each other. So whatever like the OV circuit is writing might be meant for the QK circuit to read. So analogously, we do something similar, except instead of the QK circuit of another attention head, we're going to replace that with the key vectors of GLUs. So like this is our quote unquote composition score that we come up with. And I'll walk us through what we're looking at. So previously, if you look at how the value vectors are activated, it relies on two vectors, like K gate and K up. And here, instead of the input vector X, we're just going to, so we're like looking at a specific pair of key and value vectors. But here, instead of the some input vector X, which is going to be the model's hidden state, we're simply going to replace that with the OV circuit of your attention heads. And then like this score here is for just a single pair of key value vectors. But given a set of GLU valid vectors, we're just going to take the average of score of those value vectors. Does this make sense? We're basically checking how much an OV circuit aligns with the key vectors of a GLU vector. And an analogous way to think of this is, like, again, I've talked about how these value vectors have an activation region. And so, again, we can think of these key vectors shaping some polytope that is an activation region for a value vector. And if you think of just the intersection of all these activation regions for our GLU valid weights, we're basically checking how much the OV circuit of an attention head, quote unquote, aligns with this set of activation regions that I'm calling a verification subspace.
Pop the formula back up again for three. That's the score. I see. So you're aligning the parameters, the gate parameters of your GLU with the OV parameters.
Yep. This will tell us which attention heads activate the GLU valid vectors the most. And when we do this, we like sort our 33 previous token heads based on this score, and we like incrementally ablate one at a time. And it turns out when you do this, by turning off as few as three attention heads, you can disable self-verification. Does that make sense? Any questions so far?
Sorry, what was the last thing that you just said?
Right. So like given the 33 previous token heads, we're going to try, instead of like turning off all 33, we're going to try turning off just one, see how well that works, try turning off two, try turning off three, and so on. And when you do this, it turns out that after you turn off three heads, you can disable self-verification.
Okay.
And so now here I'm showing you the activation of the GLU valid vectors. So each corresponding like neighboring pair of blue and orange bars indicate the activation of a specific GLU value vector before and after turning off the three attention heads. And so you can see that by turning off the three heads, you can basically deactivate all of your GLU valid value vectors. So my claim is, like, in this case, the three attention heads takes the model into this quote unquote verification subspace because it thinks it's found a solution. And the same quote unquote verification subspace activates your GLU weights, which will promote the likelihood of tokens like success or correct from being generated. Last part for this is we then look at what these components do in the base model. So just Qwen 2.53b before RRL fine tuning. But of course, the base model isn't trained to do countdown. But what we can do is we can provide the countdown task in the form of in-context learning with the same like structure that we like. And so if you give, I think we use like 5 demonstrations, then it turns out the model can solve countdown using the same exact chain of thought sequence. So this like adds evidence to like parallel work that like it seems like RL is just enhancing existing mechanisms. I know I think Nikhil has a paper on that. Right, so in this ICL version of the setup in the base model, we try like turning off these same components. And it turns out like if you turn off the attention or previous token heads, all 33 of them, you still see very high success rates. Out of range here means like the model generates something that doesn't that doesn't adhere to the chain of thought sequence that we want it to. Interestingly, if you turn off only the 3 verification heads, we see a much lower success rate. And we haven't like explored this further, but my hypothesis is with the RL step, it's really enhancing these 3 heads to do the self-verification task, which made it easier for us to localize.
Are these the same heads?
Yeah.
Okay.
Same exact heads.
Awesome.
Now, so we looked at Qwen 3B pre-trained and RL fine-tuned. Now we're looking at a general reasoning model, DeepSeek R1 14B. And we do the same exact procedure, like training. We actually don't train the probe, but I'll talk about how we can repeat this procedure, but the point is we can apply the same procedure to find GLU weights, attention heads, and so on, and turn those off. So in this case, I think there are, I want to say 2,000 attention heads, but if you turn off the either previous token heads or verification heads based on like the same criteria that I described before, you still see very high success rates. But interestingly, now, in the majority of cases, we see like a partial success where the model will initially say, oh yeah, 26 is not equal to 26. But then right after say, wait a second, it actually is 26 and self-correct itself. So it seems like it has a much more, perhaps like additional mechanisms for self-correction in addition to like self-verification. So by simplifying, By studying a simplified setting for reasoning, we do find this subspace that we think is relevant for self-verification, which gives us hope that perhaps we can monitor the latent space of these models to understand what they're doing for these reasoning tasks. Any questions before I try to quickly go through the last project?
So if RL is just enhancing capabilities that are already, or encouraging the model to express capabilities that are latent in the base model. But then R1 is seemingly significantly better at recovering after it's after we intervene on it. Why do you think that is? Is it just more thorough RL to express more latent base model capabilities, or do you think R1 learns something?
I think it's just because it has like more parameters. Like we're comparing like 3B models versus 14B, and I think that's just where that additional capability comes from. That's my guess.
Sure.
Okay. So hopefully I've convinced you that like if we understand the geometry of these model weights and activations, we can understand their inner computations. And then, so in this last project, I'll be talking about like similar geometries we see across language models. So this is work with some amazing mentors, This is under review for Quillen right now. And in this work, we're only going to be talking about the embedding space of language models, the embedding and unembedding weights. And what we're going to study is different geometric properties of these embedding spaces and compare them across language models in the same family. The reason why we do this comparison within the same family is because we need the embedding points to match across embedding spaces, which basically means like we need to compare models that share the same tokenizer. And so we're just looking at models that share the same tokenizer. And we compare the quote unquote global and local geometry of these embeddings. Starting with global, what we can do is given a set of points in the embedding space, we can compute a distance matrix. So given this some point for say the word he, like how similar is it to the word she, chair, desk, and so on, using cosine similarity scores. And so you construct this distance matrix D that's like V by V, the number of vocabs by number of vocabs. And then all you have to do is compare how similar the distance. So I suppose I think of this D as capturing the relative orientations of words amongst themselves. And so you can simply compare how similar these distance matrices are across language models using Pearson correlation scores. And so this is what it looks like for GPT-2, where when you compare GPT-2 small, medium, large, and extra large, you see pretty high correlation scores indicating that the relative orientations of these token embeddings are actually quite similar across language models. Does this make sense so far? And if we look at the other two model families, you actually see a very different picture for Llama 3. Any guesses as to why this is? So it turns out, like in the case of GPT-2 and Gemma, it quote unquote ties its embeddings, which means it shares the same weights for both embedding and unembedding. Whereas the case of Llama 3, it doesn't tie its embedding weights, so it learns separate weights for the unembedding part, except for like 1B and 3B. 1B and 3B share, 1B and 3B tie their embedding and unembedding weights. So in the case of Llama 3, if you do the same thing for the unembedding vectors, you see very high correlation, very high alignment. So this tells us that the kind of global, like relative orientation of token embeddings across language models are similar. Now we can look at the local geometry. And we can characterize local geometry two ways. One is by using locally linear embeddings, LLEs, and the other is by defining and looking at intrinsic dimensions. So what are LLEs, linearly local embeddings? The goal of LLE is to take some point, take k of its nearest neighbors, and to express this point as some linear combination of its k nearest neighbors. So here, if we pretend like if we care to reconstruct this blue vector, we can pretend like, let's pretend like the three other vectors are its three nearest neighbors. We want to find a set of weights that can be applied to these three neighboring embeddings to reconstruct this blue vector. So here, so in particular, this W vector here is going to be of shape R by B. Except this vector is going to be very sparse, because except for the k nearest neighbors, all other entries are going to be zeros. And you can imagine trying to learn this W vector for all of our points, like try to just re-express every point based on some weighted sum of its nearest neighbors. So that's the goal, to learn this W matrix. Does that make sense? And so you can think of this as trying to optimize this objective, where we're trying to reconstruct every point based on its nearest neighbors, where each entry of W is going to be zero if it is not the nearest neighbor of the point we're trying to reconstruct. And like the rows have to sum up to one. And it turns out there's a closed form solution for this, which makes our lives easier. But once we have this W matrix, then we can compare how similar these W weights are across language models. And so if you look at Llama, like 1B, 3B, 8B, 70B, and compute these LLE weights and compare them, you end up with very high cosine similarity scores for most of the case. What's interesting here is this big spike in cosine similarity score of zero. Any guesses as to what that might be? So we think these are quote unquote undertrained tokens. Some people call these glitch tokens, which are tokens that the tokenizer has like dedicated. It's created a token for these random tokens, but they don't show up in your training data. So then like they end up, the embeddings for these glitch tokens being just like randomly initialized vectors, which in like high dimensional space would have a cosine similarity score of zero. And so I don't think I have, like we make this claim, but one of the reviewers asked for evidence of this. And so we look for overlap in like glitch tokens that some prior work has found. And I forget the number, but there is some overlap in our tokens and their tokens. Okay, the other way to characterize local geometry is by defining this intrinsic dimension measure, where what we do is we take a token embedding, we look at its k nearest neighbors, and we apply a PC on it. We just count up the number of principal components needed to explain 95% of the variance in that like local neighborhood. And so that the number of principal components there would be our intrinsic dimension. And interestingly, if you take tokens, compute their intrinsic dimensions, like the tokens with very low intrinsic dimension often form very coherent semantic clusters, whereas tokens with higher intrinsic dimension, you don't see that semantic clustering. So like, for instance, if you look at the token for like, I don't know, Nissan, it has an intrinsic dimension of 599 out of, I think this is GPT-2, so like out of 1024 dimensions. But if you look at its nearest neighbors, you see words like Mazda, Hyundai, and so on. Same thing with like East, numbers, police, and so on. But as you go up higher in tokens with higher intrinsic dimensions, you see words like, this is just from like eyeballing some of the data, but you see words that seem to be either like suffixes or prefixes, or different lexical patterns, like words that start with G. Like here, I think these are suffixes that start with A, and so on. Right, so if you like computed the intrinsic dimension of all of your embeddings and then compare them across language models with Pearson correlation, you again see some correlation.
Sorry, you are calculating the intrinsic dimension of a token. Can you please go back to the previous slide and like just recap, how are you doing that?
So we take, say we want to measure the intrinsic dimension of the word heat.
Yeah.
We grab the embedding, we grab k of its nearest neighbors.
For k equals how many?
I think we played with like 100, 300. And then with those 300 points, you apply PCA. And then you just count up the number of principal components needed to explain like 95% or say 99%, some threshold value of the variance.
Okay.
So, and it turns out like without needing all like say 1024 dimensions, after like say like 500-ish dimensions, you can explain 95% of the variance. So we're calling that the intrinsic dimension.
300 nearest neighbors, right? So technically, if I just do QR factorization, I should not get more than 300 basis directions. So how can I get 500? Does that make sense?
Yeah. So like the numbers here, sorry. So the IDs here shown, we grabbed like a little over 1,024 neighbors because of that reason.
Okay.
Like the actual like absolute value of these IDs don't matter much, but if we instead did something like 300 or a much smaller number, like these IDs change accordingly to some smaller value, like 200-ish, say. Okay. Yeah, that was a good question.
Okay. Yeah. So K is actually 1,000.
Sorry, in this table, K is 1,000.
Okay.
We were asked like why 1,000, and so we tried 300, 500, and so. But we started with 1,000 because of that reason. Because otherwise,
So there's all these topology people who have ways of measuring intrinsic dimension. Have you compared your method to those?
We haven't. Uh-huh. I know like 2NN is another way. We haven't, but I suspect we would see similar results. Yeah. I'm starting to do some reading in that space to learn these things. Yeah. Okay, how much time do I have? Last bit. So one thing that's kind of neat, given that these language models share both global and local geometry, is that you can simply transfer your steering vectors from one model to another. So imagine you have two language models. Imagine you have some steering vector B. What you can do is you can learn a simple linear mapping across your unembedding spaces, call that T, and you can use like even something as simple as like minimizing these squares. And you can actually apply this same linear transform on your steering vector V and apply it on your other language model, and it will still work. So here are some results. So here, what we're looking at is some refusal steering vector. And the dashed blue line is if you steered llama 3-8b with a steering vector derived from llama 3-8b, from the same language model. But if you take that steering vector from llama 3-8b and just simply transfer it to llama 3b or 1b and do the steering, you see the same effect. So like this multiplier is the alpha value for like how strongly you want to scale your steering vectors. And then like more results for like different steering vectors. And if we were to think about like why this works, this is where like your point about the logit space is relevant, where like really ultimately you can think of the next token prediction task as this bilinear model where you have the last layer headed state and your unembedding space. I think of it as just taking the dot product of the last layer with all your embeddings. I'm looking for the one with highest dot products, but right. So like you said, if you simply add a direction for the word he, then of course the likelihood of he goes up. And I think this is why this steering transfer of steering vector works, because it turns out like if you look at some of the steering vectors. So here, if you looked at the first three, so the first line is a steering vector for the 3B llama model. And if you unembed it, you see words like straightforward, simple show up. Same thing with the 8B model. You see words related to myopic show up. And after this transfer from 8B model to 3B, because the unembedding space is very similar, you still see very similar words show up. Same thing with like the opposite direction. And like for many of these concepts, you see this pattern. The point, so like this says like the unembedding spaces are similar, but I think this also means like the hidden states are similar too. Like there's a very close kind of symmetric relationship between your last few layers and the unembedding space. So I don't have like evidence of this, but I think the hidden states end up becoming very similar as well. And so this is like my last slide, like why do these language models learn very similar representations? This probably has to do with the data. I wonder if there's a relationship with neural collapse where, I don't know if people are familiar with this concept, but like people have found for things like image classification, like the representations for different classes collapses into like single points. Which I kind of think of as just like the model having found an optimal representation to do this classification task for like optimal, like say separability or whatever. And so perhaps like you can think of language models as also doing classification in some context. And perhaps this is what neural collapse looks like, where like they all converge to the optimal representation to do this context classification task. So then the last hidden states and this unembedding space end up looking very similar. That's one hypothesis. Yeah, so that's all I have. I'll just conclude with, like, even though these intercomputations seem scary, like, if we understand the geometry of these embeddings and activations, we can reverse engineer even complex models. Yeah, that's all I have. Thank you for your question.
So I'm kind of curious if you've like done some more like qualitative analysis of like what lies in different regions of that like similarity histogram that you showed at the beginning of part three. Like, for example, like do function words like end up in like very different parts than like the I guess different kinds of content words?
This
more like the yes. So I think the spike at zero makes sense here, but I wonder if like the histogram basically just tracks like word frequency in the model's training set.
Yeah, I think another way to put it is like whether this tracks how well a token has been trained, perhaps. I do think my hope is if we know what an ideal geometry is, we can kind of use that as a metric for how well the model is trained at a token level. So like if we know that, like, for instance, so, okay, in a different example, like if we know what governs the intrinsic dimension of these tokens, maybe it's a property of the data, then we know what, like during training, we can observe how these intrinsic dimensions evolve for these tokens. And we can hopefully identify, okay, like this token has seen enough context and it's like fully trained, but some of these tokens need more data because it hasn't reached its ideal intrinsic dimension yet. So I've been thinking about how we can use geometry to either for like tracking, either for evaluation, I know we briefly talked about that yesterday, or for like training, monitoring training. I don't know if I answered your question. Your question was whether this just reflects frequency.
Yeah, or if there's like maybe some like structured pattern parts of the histogram. But that's also a really cool idea. Yeah. And I guess that seems sort of equivalent in a way to like just sampling training examples that are kind of adversarial or that like have very high perplexity to the model, I would think. But at more like the token level as opposed to like a full example level.
Sorry, what was that last part?
Like your idea about like I guess monitoring like the intrinsic dimensionality of certain tokens to look for things that are maybe undertrained. Mm-hmm. Feels a lot like just sampling adversarial examples for training in a way.
Adversarial meaning like?
Like they receive very high perplexity looking at the language model.
Yeah, potentially. I was thinking in terms of like identifying which tokens need more data. In terms of identifying like different patterns in like whether this tracks like frequency data, I'm not sure, but I do think there's some meaningful like features represented just in the embedding space itself. So for instance, like here, like if you run SAEs, people will be like, oh, we found a feature for like words, a concept that triggers for like words that start with G or whatever. Like, I wonder if that's just reading directly from this, a feature that's already in the embedding space. I guess this is to say, like, I'm interested in like better understanding like different patterns or structures that show up here. Maybe it has to do with word frequency, but I haven't looked at it yet. Like if you want to explore this space, like
sounds pretty cool.
Yeah.
Relatedly, have you considered or given much thought to more principled ways of selecting K? I would expect that different subspaces want different K values.
Yeah, that's a good point. So I think in the case of 2NN, which is a different way of measuring intrinsic dimension, you only need to, it only relies on two of its nearest neighbors. I don't totally understand what it does from there, but like that might be a better way to capture intrinsic dimension. Yeah. I'm very new to actually, like I've been claiming like, oh, we have to understand the geometry of these models, but I'm very new to geometry and topology actually, so.
Chris has a question.
I think like this work is amazing, and I wouldn't, you know, short sell yourself. I mean, your geometry is just very applied and you know, attached to the measurements, so which for me makes it great because I can actually understand what you're doing. and so I was wondering whether you have any thoughts on extending this to maybe analyzing the geometry of words or like anything that goes beyond single tokens, because that would be...
Yeah. If we can analyze like phrases in the hidden states, I think that'd be compelling. I just don't know how to control for like context, like what kind of context we should give it, whether it should just be like a whole bunch of random Wikipedia sentences, or maybe we can control for like the grammar of the context using like parse reader or whatever. I think there's work to be done there. I haven't thought too much about what that might look like.
All right. Yeah, if you want to chat about this, I would be happy to chat.
So a very minor question. So throughout your presentation, you kept calling the activation region polytope.
Yeah.
Why polytope? Like, why not a sphere?
In the case of GLUs, like I actually don't know what it looks like. So if we look, if we like pull up the I don't know what shape this results in, like what the subspace that satisfies this constraint.
Because you're cutting it because of Jellu.
There's then a Jellu.
It becomes a polytope. Okay.
There's a Jellu. There's also like two key vectors here. I don't know how to characterize what kind of shape results in that.
Oh, but two key vectors, but the activating region is ultimately one dot product with the value vectors. One dot product with the key vectors.
There are two dot products here, one with K up, one with K gate.
And there is a like channel wise multiplication. It's hard to think about what happens if you just multiply two things in different representations.
Maybe there's a name for this shape. I don't know what it is.
Oh, thank you.
Thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you.
So let's take a little break. Oh, did we not record? Did the recording stop?
It's recording. No, it's recording.
Oh, how do I stop it here?
Recording?
Oh, I'm not going
to record it. Probably eat food before we start if you want to. Yes.
Why am I not controlling it?
I was not considering that.
The plates are all there. Share it. The top part, this is recording. Like a stop button.
It becomes really difficult. So.